In the book club, we've been reading Gil Fronsdal's book on the hindrances, which is called Unhindered. And for those who have not been attending the book club, just a quick reminder that the hindrances are distracting thoughts and states of mind that keep us from effectively meditating, keep us from concentrating the mind. Ostensibly, this talk is on page 37. Just a couple of paragraphs on page 37, which I'm going to read now, so everyone will have done the reading. Well done. One way to avoid getting caught up at the top of the page, I think it says safeguarding the senses. So it's talking about the practice of guarding the senses or sense restraint. So he says, one way to avoid getting caught up in desire is to safeguard yourself at the sense doors. Oh yeah, and this particular practice is within the chapter on sense desire, the first of the five hindrances that we're discussing in the book club. So again, one way to avoid getting caught up in desire is to safeguard yourself at the sense doors. This means two things. First, it means to limit what you see, hear, or experience so that these things do not trigger or reinforce your desire for them. So limit what you see, hear, or experience. Secondly, another way of safeguarding the senses involves being attentive to sights, sounds, and experiences at the moment you perceive them, and then leave them alone. Do not let your mind get pulled into desire for these things. So if you can't limit what you see, hear, and experience to the point where you can actually avoid something, then if you have to pay attention to it, at least do it in such a way that you simply perceive the thing and then let it alone, if this thing might potentially trigger sense desire or ill will or some other hindrance. Do not let your mind get pulled into desire for these things. And then he suggests that we devote a few days to practice both forms of safeguarding the sense doors. And he also makes the important point that this practice is often more effective if you have a clear sense of the advantages of not being pulled into the world of desire. So that's referring to renunciation, which we talked about at length during the practice period. For instance, if you've fully embraced renunciation as a guiding principle in your life, then you do see the advantages of not letting things trigger sense desire in you. That's what Gil has to say on the topic. So let me try and flesh that out for you. So I always think it's useful to begin a talk like this by sort of putting the topic in context, where it belongs in the Eightfold Path and the gradual training. Guarding the senses is one of what we called in an earlier practice period the preliminary practices in the gradual path. A handful of practices that are meant to both help us find sort of a blameless peace and joy, a pleasant abiding here and now, and also to prepare us for the act of for the practice of meditating, to prepare us to be able to effectively abandon the hindrances when we sit down for formal meditation. So guarding the senses, also called sense restraint, is one of those preliminary practices in the gradual path, in the gradual training, rather. Then in the Eightfold Path, which is just sort of a different way of looking at the gradual training, things are just kind of grouped differently together, but they're all the same practices. In that Eightfold Path, guarding the senses is found within the three practices that make up meditation group. The Eightfold Path is usually broken up into practices in morality, practices in meditation, and then wisdom practices. And within the meditation group, which is composed of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, guarding the senses exists within the first practice of right effort, because there are four what are called great efforts, which are simply prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising. If they have arisen, abandon them, and try to create conditions that allow wholesome states of mind to arise. And once they have arisen, sustain them and perfect them. Those are the four great efforts within right effort, within the meditation group of the Eightfold Path. So that's the context. Guarding the senses is that first great effort, a way of preventing unwholesome mind states, in this case the hindrances, from arising in the first place. And you know what our grandmothers always told us, an ounce of prevention. Better to prevent them from arising in the first place rather than having to work to abandon them once they have arisen. Guarding the senses is a way of working within the world of sense stimulation. Being in the world, we're always being bombarded by sense input through the eyes, the ears, the mouth, the tongue, the nose, the body, and what the Buddha classed as the sixth sense, the mind. Considering the mind to be another sense, just like the others, makes very much sense when you realize, for instance, when you're sitting in formal meditation, when you notice just how many thoughts come bubbling up to the surface unbidden. They just sort of make contact with the conscious mind, just as sights make contact with the mind, sounds make contact with the mind. They're just as unbidden, just as we don't will them up. They just appear in the mind and make contact with consciousness, just as the input from the other senses. So it makes perfect sense to consider the mind and the thoughts that arise in the mind to be another sense and sense object. So guarding the senses is a way of working with this situation where we're always presented with sense input. The Buddha considered that situation to be a very dangerous one. He had so much to say on the dangers of just sense contact in general, and then particularly pleasant sense contact. And so I'll just share a few of the similes that he used to illustrate this danger of careless attention sense objects. In one passage in the suttas, he likens this to a tortoise, which is vulnerable to a jackal that is looking to feed. So unless the tortoise is careful and withdraws its limbs, its head and neck into its shell, the jackal can grab a piece of flesh, pull him out, and eat him. In the same way, the Buddha encouraged us to guard the senses, in the same way that that tortoise guards its own body and limbs. He, in that particular simile, the jackal is seen to be Mara, which is kind of the personification of the various forces that try to push us off the path to awakening or enlightenment. Those forces, including things like the hindrances and greed, hatred, and delusion, anything that will get in the way of us following the Buddha's path to awakening. That's Mara, the personification of those forces that try to keep us from awakening and wants to keep us in this cycle of birth, death, suffering, birth, death, suffering. So another simile is Mara as a fisherman who casts out baited hooks to lure unsuspecting fish. Pleasant sights, sounds, smells, that's the bait on the hook. And unless we're careful in how we interact with the world, unless we guard the senses, we will be hooked, and Mara will be able to do with us as he pleases. An especially powerful simile, I think, is one that talks about the agitation and affliction that sense contact, again, when we're not mindful and guarding the senses, that sense contact can cause the mind. He likens this to a flayed cow, a cow with its skin that's been removed, exposing its raw flesh to the elements. And that flayed cow is being nibbled at by various biting insects. In the same way, the Buddha says that unless we're mindful and guarding the senses, sense contact will agitate and afflict the mind. One can especially appreciate that just mere sense contact can really be very agitating. You can really appreciate that when you're deep in meditation. Kind of sums this up in another discourse. by saying these six sense bases, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, if untamed, unguarded, unprotected, unrestrained, are bringers of suffering. These same six sense bases, if well tamed, well guarded, well protected, well restrained, are bringers of happiness. We live in a world of sensory input. That doesn't mean, however, that we have to be preoccupied with sensual distraction. We don't have to always be going out into the world looking for pleasant sights and sounds. The Buddha told his monks and nuns that such a way of being in the world, sensory distraction, was what he called improper pasture. By proper pasture, he means the proper sphere of attention, what we should be directing our attention to and how. I don't know if this is just a coincidence of language or if the same sort of serendipity actually occurred in the Pali language, but that word pasture, the Pali for pasture is gokara, and it can mean literally like a pasture that a cow feeds in. It can also mean the sort of pasture of monks and nuns who go out for alms grazing, they sometimes called it, for alms. But it also, and more relevantly, I think, means a particular sphere of a sense. So there's the sense sphere that is the realm of the eyes. In other words, the sense objects that we're aware of through the eyes. There's the sense sphere of the ears and sounds. If you think of pasture as these various spheres that we become aware of through the senses, you can see that we should not, when the Buddha talks about improper pasture as sensual distraction, he was urging us not to wander in these sense fields recklessly. I hope that makes sense. I thought it was an interesting coincidence of the language. Yeah, I shouldn't have been using the word, that's why I got confused. I shouldn't have been using the word sense sphere. I should have been using the word sense field, the visual field, the auditory field, etc. So if you think of those as fields, just like a cow grazes in a field, improper pasture is not wandering recklessly in the sense fields. We should not be dwelling in sensory distraction. So what is proper pasture? The Buddha said that for his monks and nuns, proper pasture was a meditative state of mind, a mind that is mindful, filled with careful attention, and with senses restrained. That was a monk and nun's proper pasture. Of course, the Buddha being the Buddha, he had some more colorful similes to illustrate this. One is with a quail that's been caught by a hawk because it had strayed from its proper pasture. It fooled the hawk into releasing it, saying that, had I been in my proper pasture, you would not have been able to catch me. So the hawk takes him up on that, releases him. The hawk then tries to catch the quail in its proper pasture, which is filled with clumps of dirt, a freshly plowed field. And the hawk ends up bursting its breast, making a dive for the quail. So the hawk was not in its proper pasture, which led to calamity. There's a famous simile of the foolish monkey who strays from its proper pasture and gets trapped by a hunter. This trap has to do with getting its hand stuck, I think, in something sticky. And then he tries to get that hand out of the trap and ends up sticking the other hand, and then tries to use his legs to get himself out and ends up sticking his legs, and then finally uses his mouth, and he's got five parts of his body stuck in this trap. You know, it's supposed to refer to the five senses. So if we stray from our proper pasture and become involved in feeding in pleasant sensory experiences out there, we too will be stuck in Mara's trap and calamity will ensue. So again, that proper pasture is in the suttas to be well established in the four foundations of mindfulness, but it simply refers to careful attention, being mindful of appropriate objects in an appropriate way, as in, you know, the contemplations of the four foundations of mindfulness, and guarding the senses. That's how a monk and a nun should be directing his attention. The mindfulness that is such an important part of guarding the senses, we'll talk about why it's important from several angles. One is very straightforward, however, and that is simply being mindful of the fact, or keeping in mind, that we want to be guarding the senses. If we forget that we should be guarding the senses, then obviously we're not going to be able to guard the senses well. So simply keeping in mind our determination to guard the senses is important. And in the suttas, a few passages illustrate this. The Buddha instructs that one should walk thinking, while I am walking thus, no evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief will beset me. In other words, I will direct my attention in such a way that while I am walking, I will not allow desire, ill will, and other unwholesome states to arise in the mind. I will guard the senses while I am walking, so that that does not occur. In another passage, he says, bhikkhus. Bhikkhu is the Pali word for monk. Substitute nun or ourselves in there as well. Bhikkhus. This is how Nanda, who was a monk who was especially given to lust, apparently, lust for women specifically. This is how Nanda guards the doors of the sense faculties. If he needs to look to the east, he does so after he has fully considered the matter and clearly comprehends it thus. When I look to the east, bad, unwholesome states of longing and dejection will not flow in upon me. So even before he looks east, he reminds himself, I'm guarding the senses. When I look east, I will make sure that whatever I see or hear will not cause, in this case, lust to arise in the mind. So again, keeping in mind that we are guarding the senses is critical. Finally, a king, King Udena, described his practice of guarding the senses. He may not even have known that he was guarding the senses. This is just what he did at times. He says, in my case too, blessed one, when I enter my harem, guarded in body, speech, and mind, with mindfulness set up, restrained in the sense faculties, on that occasion, states of lust do not assail me. I don't think he always entered his harem while guarding the senses. At times, for some reason, he did. So, keep in mind our determination to guard the senses. That's one application of mindfulness. So I'll talk a little bit more about other applications of mindfulness in the practice of guarding the senses, but the most straightforward method for guarding the senses was actually spoken of in Gill's, that page that we read from Gil Fronsdal's book. He says, first, it means to limit what you see, hear, or experience, so that these things do not even have a chance to trigger desire or ill will or other unwholesome states. So limiting our sense input, in other words, avoiding certain situations that might overwhelm our capacity to guard the senses and keep our senses restrained. Times Square at New Year's Eve, one might choose to just avoid that situation altogether if one felt that it was just going to be too triggering in some ways. Listening to political news on the radio, if that just cannot help but getting stirred up, if you cannot help but get stirred up by listening to the latest antics of Trump or liberal wackos, whichever side of the fence you happen to be on, if you can't help but getting stirred up by listening to the radio, then maybe turn it off. So know what you're capable of. Know what is going to get you stirred up no matter how well your intentions, and perhaps avoid those situations. This kind of harkens back to an aspect of renunciation that we looked at during the practice period, which is that renunciation ideally would be not just not being attached to sense pleasures, but also avoiding some sense pleasures. So the Buddha said that we should be both internally and externally secluded from sense pleasures, at least initially on the path. And so that external seclusion from sense pleasures, where we simply avoid sense pleasures or a lot of sensory input, sensory stimulation, can occur at a monastery, at a retreat center. Those are great places for it to happen. That's why we go to those places, to deepen our practice. They allow us to withdraw from our addiction to sensory stimulation, kind of cold turkey. And then the precepts and the code of conduct that yogis on retreat and monks and nuns follow is designed to help us withdraw from sense pleasures, especially if they include the full 8 precepts, or in the case of monks and nuns, the full Patimokkha, the code of conduct, because much of those additional precepts beyond the 5 that we're used to practicing have to do with sense restraint, withdrawing from our usual set of sense pleasures, things like entertainment and luxurious furnishings and eating more than once a day or afternoon. By vowing to keep those precepts, we're saying we're going to withdraw from those sense pleasures. We're going to limit our sense input while on retreat, while in this monastery. Again, if you're avoiding those sense pleasures, if you're avoiding that sense input from TV, radio, whatever, clearly you're not going to be triggered. You're not going to be at risk of having sense desire or ill will or other unwholesome states being triggered in the mind. So pretty easy. If you can't avoid them, one other approach is by keeping the mind immersed in the body, mindfulness of the body. Many suttas in the Pali Canon talk about the importance of mindfulness in the mindfulness of the body in the practice of guarding the senses. By keeping our mind occupied with what the body is doing, with why we're doing it, with the various sensations we experience as we move the body, by keeping our mind occupied with those things, we can stay grounded and centered and are less likely to go out into the world and feed on pleasant sights and pleasant sounds and pleasant smells. Of course, we have simile. This one's well known, but it's always fun to remember. It's for some reason, a man has been charged with carrying a bowl of oil on his head, full to the brim, through a crowd of people who are all excited about the fact that the most beautiful woman in the land is going to dance and sing, is dancing and singing for them. So there's all this commotion and bustling of people around this person who has to keep this bowl of oil balanced on his head, full to the brim, and he's been told that should even one drop spill, the man behind you with the large sword is going to lop off your head. So the Buddha says, imagine the focus of such a person in that situation. And he likens that focus on the bowl of oil on that person's head to mindfulness immersed in the body. And he concludes that sutta by saying, would that man stop attending to that bowl of oil and out of negligence turn his attention outwards? I think that's a rhetorical question. So again, here the bowl of oil represents the power of mindfulness of the body to restrain our reactions to sense impressions. Restrain our reactions to sense impressions and just to keep from going out into the world and feeding. I think that's, to me, that's actually the more important point. So it's, I think of it as sort of turning down the volume on all the sensory input from the world around us. If we are immersed in the body, it's just less that makes it to the mind, I think. Another famous simile in this regard is the simile of the 6 wild animals. Imagine 6 wild animals, each with their own feeding ground that they want to get back to, but they've been tied together with ropes, and there's a knot. All those ropes have been knotted together. And imagine the battle that would ensue, those 6 wild animals each trying to get to their own particular feeding ground. So it's supposed to illustrate the agitation of a mind that is sensually distracted, the eye feeding out here, the ear feeding out there, the nose feeding on other sense input. Just impossible for the mind not to be agitated if we're going out into the world looking for pleasant sights and sounds. And then he says, but what if those six wild animals were tied to a strong post, and that post was stuck in the ground? They might struggle to get to their various feeding grounds, but eventually they would stop and would lie down next to that post, give up, and become tamed. He says, in the same way, if we use the strong post of mindfulness of the body, we can tame the senses. So we've looked at guarding the senses by limiting our exposure to sense input in the first place, turning off the radio, avoiding certain situations. Well, we can turn the volume down by immersing the mind and the body. But even with the volume turned down, we're still going to be exposed to sensory input. What we should do on top of that then is, well, we can do a couple of things. One, we can not allow the mind to react to sights and sounds and smells. We can stop at recognition and the feeling that comes with that sight or sound or whatever, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So we can stop at perception. We can see, you know, Jean. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to wake you up. We can see Jean. And I can experience the pleasant feeling that comes when I see Jean's face. And I can stop there. We can see cookies. Where are those cookies, by the way? And we can experience the pleasant feeling that comes from the sight of those cookies, but we can stop there. This not allowing feeling to then escalate into craving and fascination and infatuation is talked about in several passages in the Pali Canon. One says, on seeing a form with the eye, he does not lust after it if it is pleasing. He does not dislike it if it is unpleasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body established, having thus abandoned favoring and opposing. Whatever feeling he feels, he does not delight in that feeling, welcome it, or remain holding to it. Another passage goes into more detail, sense by sense. It says, dispel the path of lust towards forms, sights that delight the mind, and do not soil the mind by thinking those forms that give no delight are displeasing to me. Do not be enthralled with pleasant sound. Dispel the course of hate towards the raucous. Do not yield to desire for fragrant, delightful scents, and dispel aversion towards putrid stenches. Do not greedily enjoy sweet, delicious tastes. Do not feel aversion towards the bitter. When touched by pleasant contact of the body, do not be enthralled. Do not tremble when touched by pain. Look evenly on both the pleasant and painful, not drawn to or repelled by anything. stop at feeling. So we should not give what's called incorrect or careless attention to pleasant and unpleasant feeling. We should watch these arise and pass. We should watch pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings arise and pass, rather than letting them trigger afflictive mind states like greed and ill will, and then watching those arise and pass. So we can prevent that triggering of afflictive mind states if we watch feeling arise and pass. That's a wiser use of the mindfulness of watching arising and passing. Don't let it get to the point of the hindrances arising. So if you're familiar with the chain of dependent arising, the chain of a dependent origination, contact causes feeling, causes craving, causes clinging, causes suffering. What we're doing here is we're severing that chain of dependent origination at the link of feeling to craving. We don't allow feeling to lead to craving, whether that be sense desire or hatred, ill will, aversion. So that's one way to think of guarding the senses, is stopping at feeling and recognition. Another way is not... Let me step back. One way is to not allow feeling to lead to craving, hatred, sense desire, cutting that link in the chain of dependent origination, stopping at feeling. Another way to look at, stopping that chain of causation is to not allow sense contact, sense input, to lead to thoughts and thought proliferation. There's a famous sutta in which the Buddha describes another chain of causation, where he says that contact causes feeling and perception, which cause thinking, which causes thought proliferation, which is just basically an aimless train of thought and associations, this discursive thinking, as it's sometimes called, is just, one thought leading to another, all these associations and thoughts just sort of following one after another. And that thought proliferation then feeds back into that chain of causation and back into the feeling and perception link, because that thought proliferation will then itself lead to new feelings and new perceptions, will change the way we see the world. And then that will lead, those new feelings and new perceptions will lead to more thinking and more proliferation, which will then lead to new feelings and new, so just this vicious cycle of thoughts feeding this chain of what eventually leads to, just suffering and afflictive emotions. So if we can stop that vicious cycle from even beginning by just not allowing contact through the eyes, ears, nose, whatever, and the feeling that ensues to lead to thought and thought proliferation, we can prevent that from occurring. You can think of thought proliferation as kind of a Russian roulette, because if a feeling leads, if we allow sense contact to lead to thinking and more thinking and more thinking, eventually one of those thoughts is going to be highly charged and is going to trigger something that we'd rather not experience. I mean, we've all experienced this, right? We just, a train of thought just leads us down a path where suddenly we are so angry about something and we're all alone walking in the woods. Where did that come from? It's thought proliferation. Just eventually it's going to hit upon something that's going to trigger us. So it's safe just to stop at feeling and don't allow thinking to even get started. Lee Brazington, at a retreat I attended, said, guarding the senses means that you notice what's going on and you just leave it at that. You see what's there and that's it. When I heard that, it seemed like what he was saying to me was that we should experience the world like a telegraph. Not a telegraph. Experience the world like a telegram, not like a letter written in stream of consciousness. So in other words, going back to that simile of the man holding the bowl of oil full to the brim in this jostling crowd of people looking at the most beautiful woman in the world dancing and singing. If his mindfulness of the body and focus on that bowl of oil is not sufficient to keep all of that from sort of making inroads into the mind, at least what he does notice, he can notice in this way. There's a girl dancing. Stop. A crowd of people is watching. Stop. The man behind me is carrying a very large sword. Stop. So none of that's triggering him. None of it's setting a train of thought. There's a man behind me carrying a very large sword. Oh my God, what if I spill a drop? I can't let that happen. I want to live. You know, that train of thought doesn't begin. There's a man behind me carrying a very large sword. Stop. So seeing the world as a telegram, not as a letter written in the stream of consciousness.
And that's the pause, too, right? That can be...
Exactly. In a famous sutta about some advice that the Buddha gave to a man named Bahya of the bark cloth, he says, in the seen, let there be merely the seen. In the heard, let there be merely the heard. So, the last sort of way of looking at guarding the senses, but many of you who are familiar with this practice are asking, why hasn't he read sort of the standard formula for guarding the senses yet? So I'm going to do that now. And that goes, on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs or features. Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of longing and displeasure might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. So, two key phrases in there. He does not grasp at its signs or features. When he sees a form with the eye, when he hears a sound with the ear, he does not grasp at its signs or features. The other key passage here is if he left the eye faculty unguarded, unrestrained, evil, unwholesome states of longing and displeasure might invade him. Evil, unwholesome states, another translation, of covetousness and grief. He does not grasp at its signs or features. It's pretty straightforward. Just kidding. We're gonna look at that. We're gonna look at that phrase very closely, because that's something that doesn't just sort of jump out at you and say, "Oh, that's what that means." So, first of all, though, we're gonna look at the other key phrase there: evil, unwholesome states of longing and displeasure. If I left the eye faculty or the ear faculty, whatever, unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of longing and displeasure might invade the mind. So that's the purpose of restraint of the senses. It's being pointed to there. To avoid the arising of desires and discontent. To avoid reactions triggered by sensory contact and feeling. Of wanting and aversion is the purpose. So the other one, he does not grasp at its signs or features when he sees or hears, smells something. That's the method, that's the technique. And so that word sign is always trips people up. So here, first of all, are some other translations of the original Pali word for what's being translated here as sign, which is nimitta. So some other translations of that Pali word are, or some other translations of that phrase in which the Pali word is found are, he does not grasp at its marks. He does not get immersed in the general appearance. He does not seize upon its delusive appearance as a whole. We're kind of getting there. Still not quite clear. So the Visuddhimagga, which is a well-known commentary on the Pali Canon, the Buddha's discourses, tries to make things a little clearer in this way. It states, he does not seize on the general appearance refers to he does not seize on the sign of a woman or a man or any sign that is the basis for defilement, such as the sign of the pleasant, etc. He stops at what is merely seen. That didn't quite do it for me. Bhikkhu Bodhi does a better job, I think. He says, the signs, again, nimitta, are the most distinctive qualities of the object which, when unmindfully grasped, can kindle defiled thoughts. The features, remember, you do not grasp at the signs or features of the sight or sound or whatever, the object. The features are the details that subsequently catch the attention when the initial perception is not followed by restraint. So again, he says the signs are the most distinctive qualities of the object. The most distinctive qualities of the object, which when unmindfully grasped, when we're not restraining the senses, can kindle defiled thoughts. So we're getting there. So I felt that looking at a few of the other sutta passages that use that word, the same Pali word that's translated as sign, helped me to understand its meaning better. So here are a few. One sutta passage talks about the conditions or the nutriment for the hindrances, what causes the hindrances to arise. It says, and what is the nutriment for the arising of unarisen sensual desire? Frequently giving careless attention to the sign of the beautiful, to the sign, the nimitta, of the beautiful. Giving careless attention to it. That will cause the arising of sensual desire. And then it goes on to talk about the other hindrances. For instance, what is the nutriment for the arising of unarisen ill will? Frequently giving careless attention to the sign of the repulsive. Ajahn Jeff translates that as frequently giving careless attention to the theme, his word for nimitta, the theme of the irritating. So, giving careless attention, dwelling unwisely on the sign of the beautiful, the sign of the irritating. Some quality of the object, whether it's actually there or not, that can cause sense desire and ill will to arise. Perhaps that quality is something that we project onto the object. Another passage. What is the reason? I just referred to that. Another passage. When having seen a form with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, the pleasing nimitta, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, such as covetousness and annoyance, by which the mind is disturbed. So again, we're being triggered by unwisely dwelling on, attending to the pleasing sign. Again, some quality of the object, whether it's there or not, that we find pleasing. So my take on all this is that the best way of looking at that word sign, the thing which we should not grasp when attending to some sense object, is that a sign, the sign that's being referred to there is that aspect of a sense object that results in our initial perception of the object as beautiful, repulsive, irritating, etc., and which, when dwelled on, causes the arising of unwholesome states of mind. That aspect of a sense object that results in our initial perception of it as beautiful, repulsive, whatever. So, I think what's being talked about here is what Robert Wright, in a book that I know a lot of you have read or are reading at the moment. His book is called Why Buddhism is True. And he talks about Buddhist concepts through the lens of evolutionary psychology. In that book, he spends a lot of time on a topic that he calls essence. My understanding of essence from that book is best illustrated with some examples. He talks about Kennedy's, JFK's tape measure, and the fact that someone purchased it for, I think it was $400,000. He says this tape measure, if you were to be, you know, if someone were to place it in your hands and you didn't know what it was, you would just think it was any ordinary tape measure you picked up at hardware sales. No different. But for some reason, someone saw something in that tape measure that they found so desirable that they purchased it for $400,000. Identical tape measure to, you know, what you might find at hardware sales. So clearly, what he is seeing in that tape measure is being projected onto the actual object. Not an inherent quality of that object. Another example he gives is the famous study in psychology where wine experts were given two bottles of wine, one with a fancy label on it, another one with, you know, Boone's Farm on the label or something. And they were asked to talk about the qualities of those two various wines. They, you know, rhapsodized about the various qualities of the one with a fancy label on it, and you know, mise en bouteille au château written on it, and all that stuff, and poo-pooed the Boone's Farm. Turns out the labels had been switched, and so again, what they were seeing in these bottles of wine, in this case, what they were tasting, was clearly being projected onto those bottles of wine by virtue of their expectations, and various ideas. And, so this same thing, I think, happens with ordinary objects. And those that what I think of as kind of aura, or what's sometimes referred to as gestalt, or sometimes referred to as an emergent property. Hopefully one of these kind of registers well with you. That I think is being pointed to in that word sign. It's sort of the general character of a thing, a whole that is a reality, that has a reality of its own, that is independent of its parts. So one more example of that would be kind of seeing, you're traveling in France with a friend, you say, this French landscape, I just can't get enough of it. Your friend, who's maybe less romantic than you are, says, looks just like, you know, what I see in the Cascades in Washington, which is probably the case, but because this person's in France, they're, you know, plastering all these layers of, exactly, all this additional stuff onto the bare sense input. So that sign of the beautiful, of the exotic, of the romantic, that sign is what is fueling his delight in this landscape. Not the actual mountains and rivers and grass themselves. It's what he's superimposing onto the experience. That in some cases could then potentially trigger strong desire or ill will, anger, irritation. We're always superimposing, overlaying all these additional concepts and ideas Gubodi used a good word, imaginative constructs. We're always plastering these onto the bare sense input. And those are often the things that trigger the hindrances. So, that instruction, do not grasp at the signs or features. I think that's what's being pointed to there. Because the features, then are what we might normally think of as what has triggered our sense desire and ill will. Those then follow and sort of can heighten the strength of that initial sense desire or ill will or whatever. You know, we see a beautiful woman, that sign of the beautiful. Maybe it's just, you know, I'm trying to think of a better example. I can't come up with another example on spur of the moment. So, for some reason, a woman we see has just, you know, knocked us over. That initial perception is beautiful, and once we have been triggered, we might then look at, you know, the hands, the complexion, the sparkle in the eyes. These features then themselves will heighten this experience of desire and wanting. Those are what's being pointed to in the term features. But I think the sign that should not be grasped at is, again, that just that initial experience of the object that's more often than not something that can't be pointed to as much as just something that's being projected onto the object that makes us find that object beautiful or irritating, annoying, whatever. So all of this has to do with perception, and in the suttas, there's a simile given for perception. Perception is like a mirage. And so these signs and features that fascinate us and pull us in are, we should think of as nothing more than mirages, mental projections fueled by greed and aversion that we mistakenly attribute to the object as if they were actual qualities of that object. Perception as a mirage, I think that's another way of looking at that sense of essence or aura. So again, the practice of sense restraint from this point of view is to see through this mirage and don't let it draw us in or beguile us. Instead, we try to immerse our attention in what is actually there. So finally, I would once again be remiss if I didn't say a little something about the reality of this practice of guarding the senses for a layperson. I think I can say with confidence that most of us are not practicing sense restraint most of the time. You know, when we listen to a beautiful piece of music by Debussy or Joni Mitchell, you know, I think we put that record on the turntable with the intention of deliberately grasping at and immersing ourselves in the sign of the beautiful, becoming enthralled in that music, delighting in that music. It's the reason we put the music on in the first place. And we cry in movies. We love it. We delight in delicious meals. We take whole courses in art appreciation, designed to help us create stories and project essences onto what's mere pigment pigment, what's mere pigment on canvas. We throw ourselves into romantic relationships. We're not practicing sense restraint most of the time. And Gil Fronsdal wasn't in this book, but he you know, clearly states sensual pleasure is an acceptable form of happiness for lay people, according to the Buddha. We don't have to renounce it. But we can use it in certain situations to our benefit. When you can't avoid a situation, well, first of all, we can, you know, limit our exposure to things that we know are going to stir us up in a bad way. Bad, not in the, through the Buddhist lens, but bad in terms of how it feels. You know, for instance, things that are going to stir anger in us. I don't think most of us enjoy that experience. So we can limit our exposure to sights and sounds and smells that are going to stir us up towards anger and irritation and annoyance, ill will. But if we can't avoid situations that are going to stir us up, we can try to practice guarding the senses in those situations. When we know it's, you know, when we know we'd rather have some equanimity than be stirred up. Or we can just, you know, as kind of a regular practice, on occasion, practice guarding the senses to bring some peace of mind in daily life and support our meditation practice. Because remember, again, this is, you know, this page on guarding the senses is found in a book on the hindrances, which are to be abandoned so that we can meditate more deeply. So we could just regularly practice sense restraint once in a while to, you know, for those purposes. Or we could practice sense restraint continually for a limited period of time, such as on retreat. Again, together with keeping the eight precepts, which have that additional aspect of sense restraint and renunciation, that makes a, you know, makes for a powerful sort of support to deepening our practice on retreat. So, you know, at least when we're on retreat, we should probably keep in mind that we should keep the senses guarded. Or we could just sort of consider guarding the senses as an opportunity for investigation. We could guard the senses, let's say, once every other week, during on the day when we have a Saturday sit-in, and just sort of continue guarding the senses for the rest of the day and see how we like it, see what it does to our sense of well-being, our state of mind. Does it bring us a greater sense of peace and serenity? Does it help our meditation deepen? So it's an opportunity for investigation. And then we could also just see if it feels like a burden or if it makes us more joyful. We could see if, you know, if the Buddha was true to his word when he said, possessing this noble restraint of the senses, one experiences within oneself a bliss that is blameless. So we can see if it's true. So that's what I have to say about guarding the senses.